The model I presented above is built on these two generalizations. It hardly needs emphasizing how crude the model is. Nevertheless, it is valuable in identifying the crucial features of a typical boom-bust sequence. These are the unrecognized trend, the beginning of a self-reinforcing process, the successful test, the growing conviction, resulting in a widening divergence between reality and expectations, the flaw in perceptions, the climax, a self-reinforcing process in the opposite direction. Just by identifying these features, we can gain some insight into the behavior of stock prices. We cannot expect much more from our rudimentary model. In any case, a reflexive model cannot take the place of fundamental analysis. All it can do is to provide an ingredient that is missing from it. In principle, the two approaches could be reconciled. Fundamental analysis seeks to establish how underlying values are reflected in stock prices, whereas the theory of reflexivity shows how stock prices can influence underlying values. One provides a static picture, the other a dynamic one. A theory that offers a partial explanation of stock price movements can be very useful to the investor, especially if it illuminates a relationship that other investors fail to grasp. Investors operate with limited funds and limited intelligence. They do not need to know everything. As long as they understand something better than others, they have an edge. The trouble with any kind of specialized knowledge is that one's area of expertise may not be especially interesting. But the theory of reflexivity serves to identify historically significant price movements, so it goes right to the heart of the matter. The rudimentary model I have outlined above has proved extremely rewarding in my career as an investor. That may seem surprising because the model is so simple and it fits a well-trodden stock market pattern so well that one would expect every investor to be familiar with it. Yet that is not the case. Why? Part of the answer must be that market participants have been misguided by a different theoretical construction, one derived from classical economics and, even more important, from the natural sciences. The ingrained attitude is that stock prices are the passive reflection of some underlying reality and not an active ingredient in the historical process. This view is simply false. It is remarkable that the error has still not been fully recognized. Nevertheless, investors do recognize the sequence I have described and do respond to it, only they respond later than someone who is working with the appropriate model and is on the lookout for the crucial features that define the shape of the price curve. That is what has given me my edge. The first time I used the model systematically was in the conglomerate boom of the late 1960s. It enabled me to make money both on the way up and on the way down. The key to the conglomerate boom was a prevailing misconception among investors. Investors had come to value growth in per-share earnings and failed to discriminate about the way the earnings growth was accomplished. A few companies learned to produce earnings growth through acquisitions. Once the market started to reward them for their performance, their task became easier because they could offer their own highly priced stock in acquiring other companies. In theory, the process works as follows. Let us assume that all of the companies involved have the same intrinsic growth in earnings, but the stock of the acquiring company sells at twice the earnings multiple of the acquired ones. If the acquiring company manages to double its size, its earnings per share jump by 50%, and its growth rate increases accordingly. In practice, the early conglomerates started out with high intrinsic growth rates that were rewarded by high multiples. Several of the pathbreakers were high technology companies with a strong defense component whose managements recognized that their historic growth rate could not be sustained indefinitely. Textron, Teledyne, Ling Temco Vought, later LTV, to mention a few. They started to acquire more mundane companies, but as their per-share earnings growth accelerated, the multiples expanded instead of contracting. Their success attracted imitators, and later on even the most humdrum companies could attain a high multiple by going on an acquisition spree. For instance, the bulk of Ogden's earnings was derived from trading scrap metal. Nevertheless, the stock sold at more than 20 times earnings at its peak. Eventually, a company could achieve a high multiple just by promising to put it to good use by making acquisitions. Management's developed special accounting techniques that enhanced the impact of acquisitions. They also introduced changes in the acquired companies, streamlining operations, disposing of assets, and generally focusing on the bottom line. But these changes were less significant than the impact on per-share earnings of the acquisitions themselves. Investors responded. At first, the record of each company was judged on its own merit, but gradually conglomerates became recognized as a group. A new breed of investors emerged, the so-called go-go fund managers, or gunslingers, who developed a special affinity with the managements of conglomerates. Direct lines of communication were opened between them, and conglomerates would place so-called letter stock directly with investors. Eventually, conglomerates learned to manage their stock prices as well as their earnings. Events followed the sequence described in my model. Multiples expanded, and eventually reality could not sustain expectations. More and more people realized the misconception on which the boom rested, even as they continued to play the game. Acquisitions had to get larger and larger in order to maintain the momentum, and in the end, they ran into the limits of size. The climactic event was the attempt by Saul Steinberg to acquire Chemical Bank. It was fought and defeated by the establishment. When stock prices started to fall, the decline fed on itself. The favorable impact of acquisitions on per-share earnings diminished, and eventually it became impractical to make new acquisitions. The internal problems that had been swept under the carpet during the period of rapid external growth began to surface. Earnings reports revealed unpleasant surprises. Investors became disillusioned, and managements went through their own crises. After the heady days of success, few were willing to buckle down to the burdens of day-to-day management. The situation was aggravated by recession, and many of the high-flying conglomerates literally disintegrated. Investors were prepared to believe the worst, and in some cases, the worst actually occurred. In others, reality turned out to be better than expectations, and eventually the situation stabilized, with the surviving companies, often under new management, slowly working themselves out from under the debris. My best documented encounter with a boom-bust sequence is that of real estate investment trusts. REITs, as they are called, are a special corporate form brought into existence by legislation. Their key feature is that they can distribute their income free of corporate taxation, provided they distribute all the income they receive. The opportunity created by this legislation remained largely unexploited until 1969, when a large number of REITs were founded. I was present at the creation and, fresh from my experience with conglomerates, recognized their boom-bust potential. I published a research report, The Case for Mortgage Trusts. My report had an interesting history. It came at a time when go-go fund managers had suffered severe losses in the collapse of the conglomerates. Since they were entitled to share in the profits but did not have to share in the losses of the funds they managed, they were inclined to grasp at anything that held out the prospect of a quick profit. They instinctively understood how a self-reinforcing process works, since they had just participated in one, and they were anxious to play. The report found a tremendous response, whose extent I realized only when I received a telephone call from a bank in Cleveland asking for a new copy because theirs had gone through so many Xerox incarnations that it was no longer legible. There were only a few mortgage trusts in existence at the time, but the shares were so eagerly sought after that they nearly doubled in price in the space of a month or so. Demand generated supply, and there was a flood of new issues coming to market. When it became clear that the stream of new mortgage trusts was inexhaustible, prices fell almost as rapidly as they had gone up. Obviously, the readers of the report failed to take into account the ease of entry, and their mistake was corrected in short order. Nevertheless, their enthusiastic reception helped to get the self-reinforcing process described in the report underway. Subsequent events took the course outlined in the report. Mortgage trust shares enjoyed a boom that was not as violent as the one that followed the publication of the report, but turned out to be more enduring. I had invested heavily in mortgage trusts and took some profits when the reception of my study exceeded my expectations. but I was sufficiently carried away by my own success to be caught in the downdraft with a significant inventory. I hung on and even increased my positions. I followed the industry closely for a year or so and sold my holdings with good profits. Then I lost touch with the group until a few years later when problems began to surface. I was tempted to establish a short position but was handicapped in that I was no longer familiar with the terrain. Nevertheless, when I reread the report I had written several years earlier, I was persuaded by my own prediction. I decided to sell the group short, more or less indiscriminately. Moreover, as the shares fell, I maintained the same level of exposure by selling additional shares short. My original prediction was fulfilled, and most REITs went broke. The result was that I reaped more than 100% profit on my short positions, a seeming impossibility since the maximum profit on a short position is 100%. The explanation is that I kept on selling additional shares. Self-reinforcing, self-defeating cycles like the conglomerate boom and the REITs do not occur every day. There are long fallow periods when the specialist in such cycles remains unemployed. He need not starve, however. The divergence between underlying trends and investor recognition persists at all times, and the astute investor can take advantage of it. New industries arise or old ones come back into favor. Typically, they are inadequately followed at first. For instance, when defense spending started to rise in the early 1970s after a long decline, there were only two or three analysts left who followed the industry, although it still represented a substantial portion of the economy. Those who were left were too demoralized to recognize the beginning of a major new trend. That was a wonderful time to invest in defense stocks. There were high-tech defense stocks that had never been visited by an analyst, like E-Systems, Inc., and well-established companies that had fallen on evil days trying to diversify out of defense, like Sanders Associates, or getting caught up in scandals trying to sell airplanes through bribery, like Northrop and Lockheed. In the case of defense stocks, there was no self-reinforcing process involved, but investor recognition certainly helped the price of the stocks. Actually, it is a rare case where the investor's bias leaves the fundamentals totally unaffected. Even with defense stocks, the prevailing bias played a role, but it was a negative one. Lockheed had to be bailed out by the government, and companies like Sanders Associates had to restructure their debt by offering convertible bonds at prices that turned out to be very low in retrospect. Only when the negative bias was corrected was there very little further feedback. Companies had little need for additional capital, and managements, having been burned once before, were leery of diversifying out of defense. There were exceptions, like United Aircraft, but investors' bias never turned positive enough to allow a self-reinforcing process to get underway. Many of United Aircraft's acquisitions were for cash, and those that involved stock did not enhance earnings significantly. The result was a larger, diversified company, but no boom and bust in the stock.